Hello, listeners. Welcome to another edition of Politico's Nerdcast. I'm Scott Bland, your host. This week on the Nerdcast, Beto O'Rourke says he's running for president. We're going to talk a little bit about how he got to a yes on that question. Plus, we're going to talk about an emerging litmus test in the 2020 Democratic primary: campaign finance, where candidates raise their money from, how they're getting it, and where O'Rourke fits into this new test, and how his 2018 campaign kind of shaped a lot of what a lot of his now fellow 2020 candidates are talking about on the trail. Plus, we're going to talk about New York Senator and 2020 candidate Kirsten Gillibrand. She's been an outspoken advocate in the Me Too movement. But Politico reporting has uncovered how her Senate office handled, or mishandled, critics say, an allegation of inappropriate conduct inside that own office. So we're going to have our reporters who broke that story earlier this week here to talk to us about what happened and how it is going to play into the 2020 campaign. As always, quick note here, we're taping this a little bit before noon Eastern on Thursday. Today, that's March the 14th, so it's all up to date as of then. All right, let's get started. I want to welcome in our guest for our first segment here. On the line from Iowa, we've got national political reporter David Siders. Hey, David.
Hey, good to be here.
All right, and here in the studio, Maggie Severance, who covers money and politics for Politico. Hey, Maggie.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, thank you so much for being here. So time for our first data point. That is $80.3 million. That is how much money Beto O'Rourke raised when he was running for Senate in Texas in 2017 and 2018. Big record for a non-self-funder. A lot of it raised in small amounts online, speaking to the massive amount of interest there was in that campaign. And that interest culminated, in what we saw today, which is that O'Rourke, despite having lost that Senate race to Ted Cruz in 2018, is launching a campaign for president of the United States. David, you've reported as deeply as anyone else on Beto O'Rourke's presidential ambitions. So how is it? Tell us a little bit about how a three-term congressman coming off a failed Senate bid thinks that he can compete in the most crowded Democratic primary in memory. And that national following he built in 2018 has a lot to do with it.
Well, I think it's totally the fundraising and his ability to raise money from outside of Texas. You know, I think what's interesting about this 24-hour period more than maybe any other candidate is that all these other top-tier Democrats had national profiles to some extent before getting in. But O'Rourke's whole ambition is really based on the money demonstrating that national commitment to him. So we should know in 24 hours if he's for real or not. And if he raises a significant amount of money, then I think the judgment will be that he's more than just a spark. But if he comes in, you know, even with respectable, but say Hickenlooper level dollars, I think it'll be a real sour turn. So maybe more than any other candidate, the first 24 hours for him seem crucial. And that was reflected in how he was behaving in the last few days, starting to call and text donors personally, talking to operatives where he really hadn't been before, his team preparing kind of top-level supporters to send donor links to their supporters and their networks. They know that this is a really important moment for him.
And it's interesting. You're talking about the donor appeal, but what's different with, you know, maybe the way we're talking about this than we would have 10 or 20 years ago is that donor appeal is really, we're talking about donors who are giving 20, 40 bucks at a time, right? And Beto had extremely good success in 2018, kind of mobilizing people to chip in like that in a way that created this upstart campaign.
Yeah, and I think a cynic would say the reason he's able to do that is because he's young and he speaks in kind of a Gen X way, and he's white, so he doesn't maybe face criticism from reporters the same way a woman would, or certainly a woman of color. That would be maybe the cynical way to look at it. The other way is...
For, say, driving off into the middle of the country and leaving his children and his wife alone.
And there's something about him that he's really... One of the reasons he is so broadly appealing is that his policies are not clearly defined. I mean, he is something of a Rorschach test for for Democrats. They see what they want to see. And, you know, in the Senate race, he's criticized by Democrats for being way too progressive, for not moderating his views in Texas. And then as soon as that race ends, you start hearing criticism from some of those same progressives saying, actually, this guy's a right winger. And the truth is somewhere in the middle. But if you're trying to create broad appeal, there is some maybe political value in not having policies that are specifically defined, but relying more on charisma, which is certainly his brand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm curious to see how that flies in the Democratic primary. And of course, it's a very different situation for him running, having gone from running against Ted Cruz to now competing for against other Democrats for something. Maggie, I want to bring you in here because one policy where O'Rourke, like where we know absolutely where O'Rourke stands on is campaign finance. And he, part of the way that he built up this big movement in 2018 was by being very loud and proud about how he wasn't going to take money from corporate PACs, how he, you know, he was trying to run as a campaign finance purist. And we've seen a lot of Democrats in the 2018 midterms, Bernie Sanders in 2016 in the presidential race, and now in the 2020 presidential race, we've seen a lot of Democrats kind of pick this up and run with it. It's actually kind of been really the first policy flashpoint in the campaign in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it really has. And first, I would kind of point out one really interesting thing or one very Beto thing is, you know, he really ran what he said was no PACs, just people, which I just think kind of speaks to what a good marketer of himself he is that, you know, people kind of talk about campaign finance. And I think that that message, the Democratic Party has really struggled to kind of wrap its arms around that message. I think that voters are really kind of, they're concerned about corruption. And you saw Trump really seized on that well in 2016. He talked about the swamp. I think that Bernie Sanders did a really good job kind of seizing on that. And he, you know, everyone knows the $27 with Bernie Sanders, and he kind of used that to leverage it over Hillary Clinton. And now we're seeing Democratic candidates really pick it up and try and run with it. And one of the big questions is kind of who's going to succeed and who's going to kind of successfully brand themselves as a candidate who kind of is someone who's a reformer, because I think that that's someone that something that voters want. And so we've seen people say pretty much every candidate has said they're not going to take corporate PAC money. Some candidates or a lot of candidates are saying that they don't want a single candidate super PAC, which is something that happens where kind of people who a candidate maybe knows will decamp and start a super PAC. And since those people know the candidate, they kind of know how to correctly kind of choreograph the moves of that super PAC in a way that's very helpful to the campaign.
In 2016, pretty much every Republican candidate had one of these,
yeah,
right?
And we're
really not seeing that so far in 2020 for
Democrats. Yeah, and we're not seeing many of them because, you know, they're really helpful. These PACs can raise raise unlimited amounts of money, and they can spend, and they can really give you a lot of leverage over your opponents. So it's going to be really interesting. I mean, Beto is a great example of kind of the potential, I think, power and also kind of some of the potential pitfalls of this approach. You know, he's someone who successfully raised huge amounts of money, I think, in part because small dollar donors felt like they wanted to help him because he was running what he called this kind of people-powered campaign. At the end of his campaign, there was also a super PAC that came in and spent for him. And Beto was able to say, well, I don't know anything about this super PAC. I don't know what this group even is. And he was able to kind of deny any association with it. That super PAC was just run by Democrats in Washington. So there are some kind of sometimes these limits that a candidate puts them on themselves can be a little bit thinner than they seem.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this is kind of a different situation than some others. But he, I mean, he's telling the truth there, right? The this isn't something where he was kind of winking and nodding at the at this group.
Yeah, this isn't something where he was winking and nodding at this group, presumably. But you could also, I think that we could see a situation in the Democratic primary where people wind up with a lot of big money spending is kind of where I'm going. And mm-hmm. I think that we're just going to have to see where it goes. I think with Beto, another vulnerability for him is that he has kind of said that he is not going to take any PAC money. But last cycle, he also was a big recipient of oil and gas money. That's another kind of vulnerability for him.
And when you say oil and gas money, this ended up being a big controversy in like December and January when O'Rourke for President stuff was starting to bubble up. But oil and gas, it's not that the companies were giving him money, because companies can't give money to candidates, but it's people who work for oil and gas companies,
yeah.
Right? And that was how the analysis was. I'm curious.
So when you give an FEC donation, you list your address and you list your employer when you give a donation to a campaign. And so when it gets recorded to the Federal Election Commission, there's this information about you. And what kind of came out was that in aggregate, Beto, who's from Texas, had received he was one of the top recipients of donations from people who worked in the oil and gas industry. Mm-hmm. And that could have been anyone from, you know, someone who's working in an oil field to executives. And there were some executives in that total who had given him these maximum campaign donations. So it kind of raised these questions and people got into this debate. And I think we're going to see this debate surface now that we're in the presidential about kind of what should he be accepting. I don't think that there are many people who would say, when people kind of saw this total of oil and gas money, there was this kind of moment of shock, you know, of how could this person who says he doesn't take corporate, you know, he doesn't take PAC money, be accepting all this oil and gas money. Then, you know, people kind of got into it and said, well, these are all different people, the guys from Texas, you know. But I think that one thing that we're going to see in this primary is kind of, you know, everyone is trying to be the most pure candidate. Everyone is trying to be the candidate of not special interests. You know, if you're saying that you don't take money from drug companies, at what point can you not accept money from, you know, maybe you don't accept money from executives in drug companies. Okay, what about, you know, what qualifies as an executive? What qualifies as a special interest? You know, we're going to see people kind of pushing each other. I think candidates really prodding each other on where the lines are.
Yeah. David, I want to come back to you just to take us out here with respect to O'Rourke and his place in the race and where this, you know, his brand on campaign finance puts him in the race. Can you kind of place him in a continuum on the Democratic Party in terms of, you know, do we have a sense of what other candidates he's going to be competing with most strongly for support?
It's interesting because he has both the small dollar support, but also a lot of interest from, you know, there's some of the Obama Biden people who definitely are interested in his candidacy. They see a similarity there. For whatever reason, I've talked to donors who said that they had been waiting, in fact, for Biden to make up his mind. But on the other hand, those donors are likely to spread their checks around, so and to contribute to more than one candidate. So I think that his average donation probably remains a little bit higher, or probably will remain a little bit higher than Bernie Sanders, as it did in the 2018 race. But still, obviously, like many of these other Democrats, chasing lots of small dollar checks.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's going to be interesting to see his impact on the race, and it's going to be very interesting to see how this this purity test on raising money affects everyone going forward. David, thank you so much for joining us on the phone. We'll let you get back to chasing O'Rourke around Iowa.
Thanks for having me.
And Maggie, thank you so much for stepping into the studio.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, we're going to move now on to our second data point, which is three. There were 3 weeks last summer between a staffer for Senator Kirsten Gillibrand reporting sexual harassment to her superiors and then that staffer resigning in protest over how the office handled the allegation, the investigation, and then the fallout ultimately. We've got two of our reporters here to talk us through what they found when they looked into this previously unreported incident. Alex Thompson, good to have you here.
Thanks.
And Daniel Strauss, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
And also here in the studio to talk us through, we have senior politics editor Charlie Mattesian. Hey, Charlie.
Hi, Scott.
All right. So let's start with some context here, guys. You know, for background, let's first start with Senator Gillibrand's public stance and her national reputation about allegations of harassment. And she's been a national leader on this front, right, Alex?
Yeah. For the last several years, she has made it probably the defining issue, which she at least publicly speaking, you know, she led the fight on military sexual misconduct, suggesting taking certain prosecutions out of the chain of command, bringing in independent prosecutors. And she has brought this back up, you know, when the Me Too movement really gained traction right after Harvey Weinstein. She was very outspoken. Obviously, she was the first to call on Senator Al Franken to resign. And now that she has begun a presidential bid, she has made advocacy advocacy for women, the centerpiece of her campaign. She has dubbed it Woman Plus. She has said that the country is ready for the first unabashedly feminist campaign. She has said that this is her lane. This is her issue. And which makes the fact that a woman, a young, like 20-something woman in her office resigned in protest over the office's handling of that signature issue all the more interesting and, you know, potentially politically damaging.
Yeah. Well, walk us through what you found as you as you and Daniel broke the news of this this episode on Monday of this week. This had never been reported before.
So what we found was on the woman's last day, she sent a pretty scathing resignation letter to Senator Gillibrand's personal email address that just really laid into the office for its handling of the investigation, said that she felt that she had been devalued, said that she had gone against her public stances. The senator and the staff never responded to the letter. Essentially, there are two parts of this investigation. There's the first when she reports it, and they launch an investigation. There are two claims to it. One is that the man involved, his name is Abbas Malik. He has been her longtime driver since 2011.
Gillibrand's driver
since 2011. She officiated at his wedding. He was also given the title of military advisor in 2015, despite still largely remaining a driver. He has been by her side for a long, long time. By all accounts, he was excellent at his job. Senator Gillibrand then tells him that he is going to be put in a supervisory role over this woman. And the woman then reports later, alleges that he then begins making sexual advances that are unwanted and all are rebuffed. But she interprets this as him trying to use his new position in the office to get her into bed with him. And she then reports this. She also reports that he had been making inappropriate comments in the office that were demeaning to the woman and his female colleagues, calling some of them fat and ugly, raiding women that came in for interviews. And she reports both of these things. They then do an investigation. They say they don't have enough evidence. There's too much of a he said, she said. They can't substantiate the sexual harassment. They find some evidence that he'd been making inappropriate remarks. He then doesn't get the promotion, which would have come with a raise, but he keeps his job. And she, at the time, feels like, oh, well, they probably did everything they could. But soon after, she begins to think that it wasn't necessarily a fair process, and she starts getting disillusioned.
And Daniel, can you tell us a little bit about that process and of the investigation that she became disillusioned with, and what, if any, you know, rules there are about how to run these sorts of things in the Senate?
I mean, it's interesting, actually. What we found in this is that there is no hard blanket procedure throughout all Senate offices. Each Senate office has their own handbook for handling misconduct allegations.
They're essentially each operating as like their own small business,
right?
Basically.
But standard practice is to act immediately and to go to the Senate Employment Council, which is the lawyer for all Senate offices, to quickly move in and investigate allegations like this. This is what chiefs of staff we talked to said is standard procedure. It's interesting, though, because part of Gillibrand's work in working to overhaul sexual harassment policy at the Pentagon has been to bring in a third-party investigator. Her argument is that generals and people in the chain of command investigating similar accusations have a natural bias. And the argument of critics here, too, of advocates for fighting sexual harassment, is that on Capitol Hill, the standard investigators, the chief of staff, the deputy chief of staff, have a similar bias in place.
And it turns out, Alex, that in the course of reporting this story that you guys were working on, you found corroborating witnesses that the office never got in touch with because they, in the course of their investigation, didn't talk to former employees.
Exactly. The woman at the center of this, she said she pointed the office to two former employees that she said could corroborate her allegations of inappropriate workplace conduct. And the office, for reasons that are still not clear, never reached out to them. Now, we reached out to them. We actually reached out to more than 20 former employees to see if we could find a pattern of bad behavior on the part of a boss. And we found it. And one of the two people that the woman pointed the office toward, she said that a boss had regularly called her fat and ugly to her face, that at one point he made a joke about rape to her. And when we presented the office with this information, they then reopened or opened a new investigation, depending on your perspective, and they fired him last week. If they had – the woman, it's important to note, did not report the rape joke at the time. But if the office had conducted the investigation and had last summer by reaching out to former employees, they might have found out that information and we wouldn't be here now.
Charlie, can you kind of illustrate the political implications here as you see this? I mean, Gillibrand's campaign, she's a well-known senator. She's raised a lot of money in the past. Her campaign hasn't really caught fire yet. She's pretty low in a lot of the polls. But this would seem to strike directly at the heart of what she's trying to make her campaign about.
Yeah, it's a problem for her on a couple of different levels. I think if you take a look at the moment that serves as the backdrop for this scandal, it is a moment for the nation, for the Democratic Party, a reckoning. And we've seen in state legislatures across the country, and even in Congress, members have stepped down or been forced out of office for various indiscretions, for conduct that happened in their office, and there has been a political penalty to pay depending on the circumstances here. And obviously, Senator Gillibrand was not an offender here, but it was the handling. But for her, against that backdrop, given the specifics of her candidacy, given the issue set that she runs on, given her branding, it's especially damaging. And that is why it is for them is sort of almost a seven alarm fire to get this right, because it's so integral to who she is as a candidate and what she has been saying out there on the trail. Because you can take a lot of hits as a candidate for not being consistent in your positions, but you can't be inconsistent on your central core message. And that is the risk here with what Alex and Daniel have reported.
There's a quote. I mean, Gillibrand's been asked on a number of occasions, as you brought up, Alex, about why she was so quick, or at least quicker than other senators, I should say, to call for Senator Al Franken's resignation a couple years ago when he had been hit by multiple allegations of sexual harassment, sexual misconduct. And her response, to paraphrase, was basically that we can't treat our friends any differently than we as Democrats, we as feminists, can't treat our friends any differently than we treat our adversaries, or else what's the point? It's not clear how involved Gillibrand was in this investigation, but clearly the folks operating it under her direct command appear to have mishandled this.
Well, and it's interesting because her public response to the story so far has been that she has no regrets, that she has complete confidence in former chief of staff, Jess Fassler, who was technically, he did not take the lead on the investigation, but he was heavily involved in it throughout it.
And now
he is her presidential campaign manager. She has said she has complete confidence. She, you know, to Charlie's point, you know, I think she realizes that you at least they're saying that they can't admit a mistake on their signature issue, and they've been adamant that they ran a thorough process. You know, in terms of what she said about Franken, which you brought up, you know, one of the lines that came up was that none of it is okay, that we have to draw a line in the sand. And it is interesting, you know, the fact that they fired him, the driver, a boss, last week, suggests that perhaps they did make a mistake, but they have been publicly adamant that they did not.
You know, the political rhetoric on these issues, just confronted with a real life situation, just doesn't doesn't always translate over. It seems like certainly in this case,
yeah,
right. I mean, that's Alex, what you just said, that's very absolutist rhetoric, and that's not. The result that we saw here.
Right. I mean, that's the most jarring part about this. This office had basically an entire mantra that it's based on for handling this situation, and it doesn't seem to have followed it at all.
And I think that leads us to the end of this 3-week saga last summer, right, which was the beginning of your story on Monday, Alex and Daniel. It's this letter that that the former aide wrote and sent to Gillibrand as she was resigning about how this was part of the reason that she had joined this office in the first place, and that she was so disappointed in what had happened that she was leaving without another job lined up.
Well, and it's, you know, at the heart of it, the story of this young woman is sort of a story about becoming disillusioned with, you know, she describes herself, as being devastated by the 2016 election, that she really wanted to work for another woman after Donald Trump won, that she was attracted to Gillibrand's office in large part because of her public stance, and that throughout her time there, whether or not it was listening to Abbas's sort of private rhetoric, and then up to the point when they handled both the initial investigation and also the investigation into her claims of retaliation, which you can read a little bit more about in the full story, you know, she begins to just think that, and then also the fact they never even responded to a resignation letter, that they just kind of treated as like, well, I, you know, she didn't even know how to react. I think she felt that if Gillibrand's office can't get this right, then nobody in politics can get this right. And, you know, I think she's actually considering leaving politics altogether.
Wow. Well, thank you guys for coming in to talk us through that story. Great reporting. Thank you, Alex.
Hey, thanks, guys.
And thank you, Daniel.
Thanks, Scott.
Charlie, thank you as always.
Thank you as always, Scott.
And as always, a big thank you to all of you for tuning in to listen this week. Here at the end, we're going to turn things over briefly to one Nerdcast superfan. Joshua Starnes of Houston, Texas, is going to help us out with the credits this week.
Nerdcast is produced by Michaela Rodriguez. Dave Shaw is the executive producer, and their illustrator is Bill Cookman. If you like Nerdcast and you're listening on Apple Podcast, rate the show and leave a review. It helps new listeners find the show.
Thank you, Joshua. Listeners, we found Joshua because he emailed to say he was a fan. If you are a fan of the Nerdcast who wants to read the credits, please let us know. Shoot an email to nerdcast@politico.com. Thank you so much. We'll talk to you again next week.